Welcome to the Top Gear Magazine podcast, a peek behind the curtain of what it's really like to drive other people's cars for a living. These are the stories behind the stories. Hello, I'm Jack Ricks, Top Gear Magazine's editor, and joined in the studio, we got a full compliment again by Rowan Horncastle, Ollie Marriage, and Ollie Q. And this is our monthly companion pod for the new issue of the magazine. So it's issue 369. I think I've got that number right. This is the one that's got the 911 Dakar on the front, and we'll come to that in a bit. But first, been up to much, gents?
Oh, a fair bit, I think.
Well, talking of Dakar,
start to the year.
Of Dakar, I've just come out of the decompression chamber, having spent 3 weeks in the Saudi Arabian desert following it.
I thought you had a good tan.
Yeah, well, it was actually colder and wetter there than it was in the UK. I thought I was going to get a good base layer to start 2023 off, but nope. But it was very, very interesting following Audi's campaign, which you can read about on topgear.com. Started very well. Didn't end so well, but it's all a great story.
It's all drama. It's all drama at the Dakar, isn't it?
It's quite hilarious that the most complicated part of the car, which is the drivetrain, considering it's powered by a DTM engine, has three motors, incredibly complex electrical systems, that's the most bulletproof part. Mm. That's never failed in the two Dakars, but everything else around it, the variables that go along with 2 weeks of racing, mean that two cars didn't even finish.
So. Well, I don't think much would survive a nosedive off a sand dune, would it? Do you know?
Well, especially Carlos Sainz's back, which now is broken in two parts.
Really?
Yeah, two vertebrae have gone, but he's a hard man.
Despite turning around the chopper and saying, I want to race on.
That's made for a film,
hero.
Is it?
Yeah. What a hero.
Yeah, so for anyone who didn't know that, he did crash the car. He was then being helicoptered to hospital and then said, no, take me back to my car. I need to finish the stage. So they put him back in the car, and then he finished
Iron Man.
Racing drivers are a different breed, aren't they?
What have you been up to, Ollie?
I've been driving an estate car around, which isn't as glamorous on the face of it as going to Dakar Rally.
Were you a pharmaceutical rep?
I've been in motorway service stations, but they were on the way to Switzerland in the new BMW M3 Touring. Ooh. The car to end all cars. Let's cancel the podcast, finish the magazine, because nothing will ever top that, will it? Well, we found out, so I've driven it 1500 miles and to go and see, well, the world's greatest dog-themed visitor centre, Barrylands, the home of the St. Bernard Rescue Dog.
Don't give away too much. We're gonna dive fully into your doggy feature later. I can't wait. Doing anything else with the M3 Touring?
Well, then we thought, what are the rivals for the M3? And BMW would say, oh, they're none. But it turns out they're lying. There are loads. SUVs, old estate cars that cost the same as the value of the optional extras on the M3. So we've done something called M3 Touring versus the world. That's four different twin tests coming soon to topgear.com, testing just about every element of the new M3 Touring. It's the most definitive verdict you'll find on that car anywhere.
Nicely sold.
Hey ho.
Marriage?
I'm just back from America.
Oh.
I've been getting my winter sun, although it was actually snowing in Arizona one day.
You did send a brilliant...
Climate change is really disrupting our patterns of suntans in the office.
You sent a brilliant pair of videos to the group WhatsApp chat. The first one was, put that Arizona sunset, wasn't it, over a racetrack, and we went, oh, you lucky sod. And then the next one was snow in the desert. What happened?
Snow in the desert. They're having weird weather. So it is literally, we have waking up to frost on the cars in the morning, and we were driving and we thought, that's cloud, which is weird in Arizona, and then it turned out not to be cloud, but snow.
Didn't a local news team turn up?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were like, have you seen the snowman? And you, well,
the
not
snowman.
Seen
the snowman.
What, like, there's this lovely film, it's got Alec Jones singing.
He's walking through the air or whatever. But anyway, no, it's so unusual out there that they'd sent the news crews out to go and record snow falling on cactuses.
Not that the man from Top Gear was in town here to drift anything that he could, including the cactus around.
No, we went out there to do a whole bunch of stuff. So I flew into LA and did some stuff with Singer in LA. And then I drove across to Phoenix in Arizona and was doing whole bunch of exciting stuff there. The one, the thing I would love was brilliant, was the Barrett Jackson auction. Because if you've never heard of a Barrett Jackson auction, we think we know what auctions are. Auctions are these sort of gilded events of cars parked on golf courses with very smart people sipping champagne. Barrett Jackson is like a cattle auction. It's just sort of machine gun delivery of people. 2,000 cars go across the cross the line every week. And it's this amazing event. 400,000 people turn up to watch a Barrett Jackson over the course of 5 days.
Wow.
It's enormous. It holds world records for the length of the marquee. There's the marquee that it's hosting under is 0.8 of a mile long. So it's just this giant, giant event.
Imagine the wedding reception you could have in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Or the drag race for all the muscle cars. Under its head. Yeah. Then you can get out of the snow.
Isn't it? Highest speed in a marquee.
Oh, no, that one down.
Yeah. There was plenty of cars there that could have done quite well in that.
Did you manage to keep your paddle from twitching?
Oh, yeah, you have to. It's quite a process. But I assume because you've got like they've said they register something like 10,000 bidders can register to bid on the cars. But in order to do that, I said, "Well, how are they doing it? Is it an app on your phone you bid with? Is there a sort of is there a digital thing?" No, it is all done by raising a hand. So it's 4,000 people. So they have these people whose job is to relay the bids from distant parts of the audience forward to the stage, where this bloke just sort of goes. and then there'll be a thousand thrown in there somewhere. It's absolutely incredible.
It sounds like the most dangerous place to hold a stag do.
Yeah.
Oh god.
Yeah.
What you come back with?
If you register as a bidder, I think you get something like 10 free beers a day because
that's not a coincidence.
No, it's not a coincidence.
Rishi needs this as an economic policy. This is how we get out of the recession.
And they're a bidder. The other thing is they're bid assistants. And bid assistants are there literally to force you or to help you bid on the cars. So they are there to go on, come on, man, you can do another 1,000. Get another 1,000.
G you up. Have another beer.
Have another beer.
Professional peer pressure.
Tequila?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Oh
amazing. Fantastic. Mega. So actually, that full story is hopefully going to be in the following issue.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll dive a little deeper into that.
There's a video too, right?
Next month.
Yep.
Oh, it's all happening. Content machine out in America, yeah. Ollie Mode. I have been also on the Dakar, different Dakar, the 9/11 one. So it's been a busy last couple of weeks, sort of two-part story, really, for the magazine and also for video. So you can watch that on YouTube now. The first part was in Morocco. So we went off. This was the official Porsche launch of the 9/11 Dakar, where they took us, I have to say, fair play to where they parachuted us into, not literally parachuted us, but flew us into.
That's whatever, press launch, yeah.
Ericadia? I knew I was going to pronounce that wrong. It's on the sort of between the Atlas Mountains and the border with Algeria in the east, middle of nowhere. There's a bit of a town that we landed into and then off into the middle of the dunes to show us the sort of punishment that this car could take. And then a week later, got back to Europe, went out to Germany, borrowed another car, and then headed off in search of snow. So this was the sort of this two-part fire and ice journey that we wanted to put this car.
But just to refresh
the ringer.
People, this 911 Dakar, this is the off-road 911, the kind of, you know, the last
crossover.
Niche. Yeah, the last niche that the 911 could do. I don't know what else could be done, really.
Yeah, inspired by their success in the Dakar Rally of the 1980s, but then using modern technology to effectively make a zombie apocalypse-proof 911 GTS, right?
Yeah, because I'm sure they must have seen what was going on in Southern California of everyone making, you know, 911 safaris. I do believe that they tried to get the trademark for 911 Safari, but...
Yeah, Tata own it.
No.
So, yeah, it's the Indian steel conglomerate, which have obviously got their own car company and made that thing you might have heard of, the Tata Nano, got some publicity about a decade ago for being like the world's
cheapest car.
Yeah, I think they own Tata Safari for some sort of SUV that's sold in India and they wouldn't give it. Porsche came knocking, would you mind awfully, we'd like to call our new, you know, £250,000 911 that name. And they went, no. So that's why it's called the Dakar.
Yeah, which is because they actually did that concept in 2012. So you remember that big book, coffee table book, they did Unseen. So with the 991, 911, they did it. They built this prototype, presented it to the board, and the board weren't interested. So they obviously bided their time and had another crack with the next generation of 911. And this one, they managed to slip through. I was sort of toying with that idea of like, why not then? Why now? And is it the fact that the whole car industry is you know, the amount of choice, the amount of niches are just exploding. You know, you look at a 911 now, it goes all the way from a 911 GT3 RS to a Dakar. They're just trying to expand their footprint and cater for everyone and offer as much niche as possible. I don't know.
Maybe it's just that when they tried it last with the 991 10 years ago, Instagram wasn't as big. And now there's just more people you can show off to with your different niche.
And money. Money, I think, plays a big part in it. If you know, limited edition Porsches, they're just going bananas. But it's a weird, if you look at it, it's a bit of an odd spec to get your head around, because there's bits from other, you know, GT3s. It's based on a GTS. So was it 473 horsepower? Yeah. You may think it'd be, you know, a turbo, but it's not. So it's
limited edition.
It's limited edition.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a sort of Frankenstein, really. Yeah, limited edition.
2,500 they're doing, aren't they?
2,500, £173,000 starting point, but that's before you've started adding on roof racks and roof tents. And
what does the livery cost?
Paint. So that...
That rough roads.
So the rough roads...
We're honestly not a tobacco sponsor here.
We're not allowed to talk about smoking fags anymore. So rough roads, which actually, if you squint, it's actually... Yeah. I'd love to be in the meeting where they were sort of, you know, brainstorming. What looks a bit like Rothmans when you sort of... You're at a distance. Rough roads, that'll do. So this one is a rally design package, so...
That gets you the white wheels, the blue and white livery, the gold and red stripes.
Exactly.
And then...
So the blue and white
a number on
two-tone
the side.
Paint, that's proper paint.
Yeah.
And the stripes are actually stickers. But as a whole, it's £18,500. They're pushing it hard as well. If you go on the configurator, you say, you know, 911 Dakar, configure your own car. And then the default setting is the £18,500 rally design package. And you're like, don't want that. I'll decide whether I add that. And then you have to go back and say, no, I'll start
because
from scratch.
We saw it in LA, didn't we? And then they just had a normal, you know, just a standard paint as well, which I think looks better.
Because
then it jumps. You go, oh, that's a bit of a weird 911. But also, I didn't realise that you could get other liveries as well.
Well, they only announced this just before the launch, that you can get these kind of, they're effectively wraps. So they're a bit cheaper. They're kind of £4,000 to £6,000 instead of £20,000. And they all kind of nod to 70s heritage liveries used in the sort of African safari rally and stuff.
I thought the Martini one looks a bit...
Yeah, kitsch. To be honest, yeah.
There's an irony, isn't there, as well, in getting a really expensive wrap or even more expensive paint job put on a car which has been designed and engineered to be, well, Jack, as you found out, pretty much indestructible.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, it's a hipster spec 911, isn't it? You know, I always compare it to the world of motorbikes, Rowan. I know you're into a little bit of hipster motorbiking yourself, but the whole kind of scrambler thing, stripping it down, modifying it slightly, you know, giving a bike this kind of desert scrambler credentials, but it just drives around South London. You know, that's been going on for a while. So that's what's interesting about this car. I think it will be... It's definitely a fashion statement, but maybe that's why Porsche was so insistent that they needed to show us what it could do rather than just launching it in Stuttgart.
And what it could do, because I was in the desert when these pictures came in, the photography from this feature is, and I have to applaud you on your confidence in the driving that you displayed, is rather miraculous. And there is sand about 60 foot in the air coming off every single tyre, firing over dunes.
I'm still fishing the sand out of my pants, to be honest. I always say, I stick my hands up, I am not a hot shoe driver. You know, you give me a GT3 RS on a racetrack and I'm good, very, very cautious, you know, skidding that thing around because my skill level only takes me so far. What was brilliant, so the first day we landed in this airport, we went in convoy through Morocco. And they sort of casually said on the radio, should we make a stop off at the playground? That sounds good. Yes, we'll stop at the playground.
But you do love a slide.
Exactly. I just wanted to go on the swings. What it turned out to be was this enormous flat plane with this really soft, fine sand on it. And then the sand dunes in the background. So photography heaven, basically, because you got this perfect backdrop and just go nuts. It was just this enormous area. There was a few sort of shrubby bushes to aim at, but essentially that. And what was great is normally, you know, you might kind of launch and they don't turn the ESC off or, you know, just be careful. There's only a limited number. They were actively encouraging it. Yep, just go over there, skid around, see if you can break it. And off we went. And within minutes, I was just drifting everywhere because, you know, everything happens at lower speeds. You've got this four-wheel drive system, a new rally mode that sends 80% of the power to the rear. And it was basically what I watch Ollie doing day in, day out on a track, and the weight transfer and the way he adds the opposite lock and takes it off. And
for
I'm
people
like,
listening,
I get it.
There is air steering going on right now. You can't see. You might not be able to see this if you're not watching the video, but Jack is drifting the wheelie chair around the microphone. Sorry, Jack, you were saying about weight transfer.
but you know, and I see these things happen, but much harder to do in real life. Suddenly it all came to me and it was easy. I think at one point I get a bit carried away in the video and yell that I'm a driving god.
The famous Richard Hammond line, which YouTube has picked up on quite...
The internet, that was not a Richard Hammond reference. That was just me getting overexcited. Anyway, it's simple. You know, it wants to live sideways. It's happening at lower speeds. It's just great, great fun. And then what happens when the sand starts to cut up? You get these really big ruts and you're slamming into them sideways. And you sort of... It's at that point you realise, actually, this can take... a lot of punishment, this car. And then day two, we were in the dunes, so much deeper sand, completely different technique. Basically, don't get buried. It was quite serious. You have one of those chats where the instructor like explained all the things not to do, and you immediately, and then you go out and go, please.
Did you get stuck?
No, I didn't get stuck. I won't name any other journalists. Names.
The big red, it's got massive red towing eyes on it, the front of the Dakar, hasn't it? Yeah, you're saying that some of those have had the paint chipped off them.
Oh, yeah. There was a fleet of Toyota Land Cruisers that were sort of going around fishing journalists out of.
Not Porsche Cayennes. That's interesting.
There was a Cayenne there as well, but the Land Cruisers were doing the donkey work.
And is the technique just to keep it pinned?
Just keep it pinned, really. I mean, because it was a. Surf. You want to surf the kind of surface of the deep sand. So don't stop. Don't stop moving. If you do stop, don't stop on an upslope. If
That's
you
S do stop, seven once yeah. said.
Don't stop. Never stop on an upslope. And don't hit the brakes too hard because you get this pile of sand that builds up in front of your tires, and then you can't get moving again. So all these things are swirling around your head, and basically it just boils down to. A full send then. So you're second gear, keep it, bah, 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 and off you go, just bouncing off the limiter, sliding everywhere.
So a big part of this car was the Pirelli Scorpion tyres. Mm. They are standard, aren't they? Then you can get optional road tyres, but they limit the top speed to 149 or something, 150
exactly.
miles an hour?
149 miles an hour on the standard Pirelli Scorpions. So two things about these tyres. They look amazing. There's been a little bit of conversation around, did they go far enough with the Dakar? When you first saw it, you said it was a 911 all-road, didn't
you? I came back going, it's a bit too on the Audi all-road side and not enough like a monster truck, which is what I kind of expected. But
the tyres...
I'll eat my words because you didn't get stuck.
I didn't get stuck, yeah. And it didn't break. I did pop a tyre off the rim because you have to...
Oh, well done. That's quite an achievement.
It made quite an interesting crunchy noise as it was smashing around the wheel arch. But all good. Put a bit of air in it and we popped it back on. But, these tyres, they're fantastic because we got to drive them on the road. Yeah, smooth.
And for people who haven't seen them, they're properly... Well, not proper knobbly tyres, but the tread in them is far superior to anything else that you've ever seen on a 911.
There's 9 mm.
Or on like a BMW X5 or a Land Rover Discovery. They look like serious off-road rubber.
Yeah, and I spoke to the guy from Pirelli, actually, and it was a big challenge because they said, look, we want to fit these tyres as standard because that's how the car should look and it should have those kind of abilities baked in. And then it was about, right, well, how do I get the handling? How do we get the sort of refinement when you're driving it down the King's Road? And they appear to have pulled it off. But we did get to try the car on winters as well, because that was part two in Germany where we
For everyone else, you may have seen it, and this is why you should check out the YouTube channel and the magazine, is that everyone drove it in Morocco. And then we got wind that Porsche were going to take the car to the GP ice race in Austria. However, as with all the crazy weather that's going on, there was no ice at the GP ice race.
Or anywhere in Europe, and apart from glaciers.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. You had to go to Arizona to get the snow. But for everyone who doesn't know how these work, when we first saw the 911 in November in LA, we started pitching ideas for what to do with it. And us being Top Gear, we wanted to do the most ambitious stuff possible. So when we heard that the launch was in Morocco and then it needed to be in Austria, our initial thought was, no problem, you'll need to get that car from Morocco to Austria. We'll drive it. So Jack spent weeks and weeks trying to convince Porsche that we can, but then...
Well, they were fairly convinced, to be honest, but it was there were issues around crossing borders.
Customs.
Customs and all that sort of stuff, which just is a massive headache. So then we were like, well, let's do it in two parts. We'll cut out the road trip bit in the middle and just drive it on sand and drive it on ice. So they freed up a car, exact same spec that we had in Morocco, which...
Just made, without the sand accoutrements in the cabin.
And on winter tires, not on the Pirelli Scorpions. And I'd like to say that was, fantastic piece of planning, but it was just blind luck. There was one,
There
was one car in Germany and it just happened to match the one that we just randomly picked out in Morocco. So that's great. But that was really good fun. Yeah, no snow, no ice. So the idea was land in Germany and go and find where the snow and where the ice is. Landed at Stuttgart Airport and it was hooning it down with snow for the first time in months out there. We were like, oh, this is easy. But off we went to the Panoramastrasse, the Rossfeld Panoramastrasse, which is this high panoramic road, toll road, €7 to get in. And we basically had the whole place to ourselves. It was absolute magic.
It looks amazing.
It was magic.
And then when I saw the pictures of the Safari, not the Safari, the Dakar, sorry, Tata.
you owe Tata 100 quid.
We're used to now seeing that livery in this car in a sandy environment. So when you see it somewhere else, I actually think it looks cooler in the kind of snowy environment than it does in the sand. And that's what we try and get across with the visuals. But again, the confident driving and what you learned in Morocco, that really translated to Germany too.
Honestly, yeah, maybe I was a bit too overconfident. I don't know, but look, I'd like to credit the car there because it really does breed confidence with the four-wheel drive system. And on ice, it's happening even slower, less traction. I'm coming around these hairpins, make sure you got the slow-mo function on the camera, I'm saying to the cameraman, because as I come around on the lock stops,
there's more air steering.
5 miles an hour. Ooh, look at me.
There's a great shot as one of the rear wheels is just kissing up the bounce that gets the snow built up at the edge of the road.
Yeah,
I was thinking, oh, hey, Jack's got his skills on.
That wasn't planned. Yeah, he was very happy it was there too, otherwise it was barrier.
Okay. So, Jack's got his luck on. More like
same
it.
Question as the desert though. Did you get stuck in the snow?
No, we didn't. When we first arrived at the road, it was literally, it'd been snowing all night. So there was a foot of powder on the road. So I was like, this is insane. And there we were. I mean, how good are winter tires, by the way? We were just driving uphill in a foot of powder snow in a Porsche 911, just pulling grip from God knows where. And then the snowplow came and flattened it all out, which meant you got all the slippiness, but you didn't have the powder everywhere. But what was the question again?
Did you get stuck?
No, I didn't get stuck.
I'm just amazed that you drove it on two of, what's supposed to be the harshest terrain possible. And, it's a Porsche 911 at the end of the day. Yes, it's a bit taller and it's got some chunky tyres on it. But, there's plenty of people who every time there's a half an inch of snow in England, careen off the road in their SUV.
Yeah.
And
fit a tow bar. It's the wet grass test next, isn't it? Towing a horse box.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what the icy adventure made me think was, a lot of people looking at this car going, look, who's going to spend £200,000 and go and smash around in the desert in this thing? It's all just a fancy hipster spec, speculators, limited edition 911. But actually, the icy leg of the trip made me think, anyone, you could go and do this. If you buy a 911 Dakar, unless you live in, the Middle East, you can point the car at some altitude, you can find some snow and some ice, and you can go and slide it around like this quite safely and really have some good fun. And I think everyone should, who gets one of these cars, go and drive it properly, because it's such a shame if it's just driven.
But also,
around.
People have said, is it a better road car? You've got more height.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it softer? Is it a better 911 just to use day-to-day too? You don't need to go to dunes, and is it just cool to have just to smash around in?
It rides better. It's, on these Pirelli Scorpions, the sort of tyre noise is equivalent to winter tyres. So it's not intrusive. I think it looks fantastic. All the power you could possibly need in that 475 horsepower GTS engine.
Oh, I think a base 911 is all the power you need a lot of the time. Quick regardless.
Exactly. And get this. So Walter Roll, who's a Porsche brand ambassador, was out in Morocco.
Famous rally driver for all the younger people. Around there, Group B era, but, just general hero.
Have a flick through YouTube and look at this guy. Anyway, he's bought one. and was really interested. So he's 75 years old now. And I was like, oh.
Easier to get in.
Yeah. He hasn't gone for the roof tent, funnily enough. Not interested in that. Not interested in the roof rack. He's gone for a dark green colour. And the reason, he says, is, oh, it's slightly easier to get in and out of.
Oh.
And it's more comfortable to use day to day. He says it's just going to be my daily driver in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, isn't there this crazy stat, I'll tee you up here, Jack, that it's got the same Nürburgring time as one of Walter Röhrl's greatest moments. I heard somewhere, is it the GT3?
Yes, you tee it up, I'll smash them out the park. 2003, so he drove the 996 GT3 around the Nürburgring. The first production car to go under 8 minutes, so 7 minutes 56, something like that.
Mind-blowing time.
Order. Yeah, Batman. Mind-blowing time.
Wow.
This car on the Pirelli Scorpion tyres will match that around the Nürburgring.
On the Scorpion tyres?
Yes. With a limited top speed of 149 miles an hour. I'm actually not sure what the top speed on a 996 GT3
is. More than that, into the 170.
Yeah.
If not more. So that's crazy.
Phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that really hit home for me.
And yet it's got all the sump guards and everything underneath, and the guards underneath. So it's
just take all the curb you want, I guess.
Yeah. How much the corners do you just straight say,
maybe that does involve a healthy shortcut at some point.
Just goes over the gravel trap as soon as you get to your chicane.
Well, there we go.
Awesome. Well, no, it's the cover story. It's a YouTube video. It's now a podcast. It's a great little adventure that we try to add a little difference to by taking it to the ice. I hope we see more of this car. I know that they're going to get one in the UK and we could do more things with it. It'll be interesting to see what owners do with them and whether we ever see them out and about. There is obviously going to be a weird owner, not a weird owner, a proper owner who goes and uses it every day and puts it on Instagram and makes a point about putting loads of miles on it. But for everyone else, I guess Jack says, you know, go and use it.
Yeah, I think, you know, people say, oh, you can drive it around on rocks and gravel and dent it. And I think it'll look better. Few dents and scratches and that. Oh,
that's called patina, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's called patina.
Right, what else have we got in the issue?
We also have the headline, Boss Level Unlocked. So this was the fairly surreal moment where just before our TopGear.com awards, which was just before Christmas, we managed to get together four of the biggest names in the performance car industry into one room in a pub opposite the Top Gear offices. So John Hennessy, Matej Rimac, Gordon Murray and Christian von Koenigsegg all together in one place. And the idea is simple as that, really. You know, we've interviewed each of them multiple times individually where they are laser focused and, you know, banging the drum of their own particular company, but put them together in one place and just throw some topics at them and get them to talk to each other about stories from the past, what's happening now, the future of the motor car. And it's just, it was absolutely fascinating.
It was amazing to be there and see it. And it's amazing what happens when you put a pint in someone's hand and remove the PR person and just get and then fire subjects at them, which, as Jack said, normally you can't in a motor show or a round table or something like that. These are all people we speak to a lot and are very relaxed around us. But, you know, there are some amazing questions and answers that you can... The episode's already in the feed, the full length. I think it's an hour long. Roundtable, basically.
That full podcast, so yeah, video on YouTube, go and watch it now. Full podcast is in the feed. I think it was released a week before you're listening to this podcast, and it's a feature in the magazine. Amazing photography again with this one. Some really lovely portrait photography.
It's the maddest album cover you've ever
Tom
seen.
Barnes.
Yeah, exactly. It's the weirdest band because you've got John Hennessy, Matej Rimac, The Stig, Gordon Murray, and then Christian von Koenigsegg all looking like they're going to play some jazz at you.
What roles would they play in a band? Because Gordon's obviously quite a big musical.
He's keyboard.
Fan.
He's definitely keyboard. He's got four of them. Lightweight
he's
ones.
He's playing the tambourine.
Drums,
the lightest
isn't he?
Instrument.
Yeah. Christian's definitely on.
Is he on
John.
The drums? Or I think the sort of brass section. I don't know. I could just imagine him with the trumpet.
Or riffing on a saxophone.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Christian von Koenigsegg on the saxophone. Matej Rimac.
Producing.
Vocals.
At the back.
And John Hennessy.
Banjo.
Lovely. That's
anyway, but yeah,
then.
Check that one out on YouTube and in the podcast feed. But there's a fascinating their take on Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Because they've all had personal relations with him, and their view on him is just eye-opening. So
yeah, and fair play to them all for agreeing to do it, really, because normally, as Rowan says, you have a PR. They have a PR standing next to them, a certain set of questions they're not allowed to answer, and they agree.
It's usually their event rather than our event, isn't it? Sure. That's the thing. They're usually there. They're put in front of us because they've got something they need to communicate.
And what was hilarious afterwards, so we wrapped up, and we then had to get to our Top Gear Awards event and sort all that out. And I thought, well, you know, surely these are busy CEOs. They'll then open their laptops, go to a hotel room and, you know, do $1 million, $1 billion
about a
deals, whatever.
Window, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Before the awards started.
And then they were like, should we just have a pint? And I was, yeah, fine. So we ended up having quite a few pints. So I put this image on Twitter and Instagram of them all sat in a very London boozer. And after, you know, the conversation after that, where they all got tucked in, was fantastic. Yeah. But they arrived at the awards pretty lubricated before it even begun. So.
Which is great, because I got to sit next to Matteo Rimatz, and he was a few pints down. And I was like, so tell me about the future of Bugatti.
Which you'll see soon in Top Gear. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then we get to an absolute dog of a feature written by Ollie Q over here. So go on then. Why is there a St. Bernard poking out of the rear windscreen of an M3 Touring?
To which the obvious answer is, why not? Yes. So this, I'm glad Ollie's here. I can't take full credit for this. It's Ollie Marriage who put me onto this fantastic location in Switzerland, isn't it, Ollie? It's the home of the St. Bernard Rescue
Exactly.
Dog.
So how it all came about was it was a pre-COVID feature that we were meant to do with the RS6 when it launched, which was the month before COVID kicked off. So we were going out there to do it, and then it all got put on hold because of COVID back in 2020. So when the M3 Touring came along, I said to Ollie, I know what you're going to do with this. I've got it for you. It's all set up already.
There is this strange, weird sort of fetishization of, you know, estate cars are great for carrying dogs around. We all have a fast estate car because it's meant to be the best of both worlds. There's this strange dichotomy that you'd never drive fast when you had a dog on board. So you could argue it's a silly thing, but we just love that template, don't we? And whether it's an RS6 or a C63 wagon or, you know, any flavour thereof, and there's been different variations through the years, and Jaguar's dabbled with them. We've always loved these cars, but there's always been a sort of a missing name among that, and that is an M3 Touring. There's been concepts and renderings, but this is finally the first production M3 Touring. You can only get it with the automatic gearbox, not the manual. You can only get it in four-wheel drive, but it's here. It's £83,000 before options, so it's an expensive lump of car, but it could be all the car any of us could ever want, need.
It could also be, if they don't sell many of them, the last M3 Touring. Well, who knows what an M3 is going to look like in the future.
Yeah, but I think that's why they've timed it now. I think they've looked at the sort of the state of things and gone, we haven't really got long. If we're going to do this, it's going to all be electric soon. Why not do it now? Also, the C63 is having this kind of hybrid identity crisis now. The RS4 is very old, so BMW has just swooped and timed it rather brilliantly. So we wanted to do some distance in it, you know, test its GT credentials to check what it's like to live with. And we wanted to go and find some great roads, and we needed a dog angle. So Switzerland
the
it was.
St. Bernard Pass it was.
Yeah, so the St. Bernard Pass is named after the Grand St. Bernard Hospice, which was a monastery and a hospice on top of the mountains on the Swiss-Italian border. There were monks there. They used to volunteer to aid travellers who were perhaps stranded getting across the border in the days before you could just, you know, go through a tunnel. And they used to breed these very friendly dogs, which were good at sniffing out climbers and travellers who were trapped perhaps in an avalanche or had, you know, become exhausted in the wintry conditions.
And giving them whiskey from barrels around their necks.
Brandy.
Brandy.
That's where the QI alarm would go off. So that's the first thing I learned, is that is not true. If you've seen a St. Bernard, it'll always have a barrel around its neck containing brandy to, you know, little nip for a keep the winter cold at bay. Not true. That comes from a painting from 1820 by a British artist.
Of course.
Showing a St. Bernard rescuing someone stranded in the snow, and he embellished it with this, the dogs brought him some brandy. And now every single picture of a St. Bernard ever has got all of their photos, even the cuddly toys in the gift shop have got cuddly barrels of brandy around their necks.
Well, I think it's a good idea.
So go on, tell everyone why it's called Barryland.
Barryland. It's a pretty underwhelming
name,
isn't it? It does sound better in a kind of Franco-Swiss accent. That's because the most famous, celebrated, legendary St. Bernard of all time is a dog from the mid-19th century who's called Barry.
Go on, Barry.
And Barry is credited with, it's between, I saw everything between 40 and 100 rescues, 100 lives saved, saving people from avalanche, children who had got lost in the snow. There's even a story that a child once climbed on his back and rode to safety out of the mountains. And there's paintings of this as well. So Barry is a legendary dog.
Any dog
people, any crafts enthusiasts listening will have heard of Barry the St. Bernard. And so they continue his legend, his legacy, by naming the visitor centre after him and by naming his lineage after him. So they, to this day, have a male called Barry, and he is continuing the bloodline. And yeah, so you can go, pay a couple of euros, and you go into this place, and as usual, you go in through the gift shop where you can buy Barry wine and Barry cuddly toys.
Hang on.
Barry themed cuckoo clocks.
Barry wine. So there's
Barry red and Barry white. Open the dog wine, darling. It's date night. And then there's a lovely, really, really interesting museum. I mean, my French isn't up to much, but I was going through the museum, all these photos of the St. Bernards, you know, back in the day being trained up in the mountains, and how the trainings for them has changed over the years, how the dog's look has changed over the years.
Oh,
because
yeah,
during the mid-18th century, they were crossbred with Newfoundlands after many of the breeding pairs were killed in an avalanche. So they had to save the breed, they had to be crossbred with Newfoundlands. And that's when they became much bigger and stockier and had thicker fur, and ironically became worse at going out in the cold because their fur would become waterlogged. So there you go.
So Barry didn't actually look necessarily like the St. Bernards we know today.
Yeah, if there's any children listening, this is a slightly grisly St. Bernard fact. But so Barry's cadaver is taxidermied. They've preserved him.
Oh, dear.
But because
you didn't bring him back in the boot, did you?
No, but the problem is that because he's like a sort of like an OG St. Bernard, as they were crossbred and moved on, they no longer look like him. So they modified his body. They sort of changed the shape of his skull so he looks like a St. Bernard does today, which is really weird.
But anyway, here's an insight into the Top Gear office where we start talking about cars, then we get onto dogs for 80% of the conversation.
Oh, yeah, the M3.
An M3.
The major question, can you get a St. Bernard in the carbon bucket seats, the optional ones of an M3 Touring?
No. You can't get, right? We tried. You can't get one in the carbon bucket seats, but you can get two in the boots with the seats down. And they do not need much encouragement. Let me tell you, they're straight in there.
Was it 500 litres?
It's 500 litres with all five seats up. It's 1,505 with all the seats down. Rip the parcel shelf out. And yeah, there's we had Barry and his missus, Jenga. They they leapt in. And if you are buying the M3 that was featured in this, immortalised in this feature, then I can only apologise for the slobber and fur that was deposited in the back of it. But yeah, I mean, as a thorough practicality test goes, I think 80 kilo dogs. Yeah, the female was 75, which is what I weigh, and the male was 80 kilos. You know, the thing squatted down as they got in. But you can, there you go, you can ultimate dog wagon tick. It's and also the car is, you know, as I do lightly touch on in the feature, the car's quite good as well to drive, actually.
This is an interesting point, because obviously lots of controversy around new M3, the face of it, the fact that it uses an automatic gearbox and, you know, weighs a fair bit and all these sorts of things. So ultimately, it's a very well engineered and very well sorted car and astonishingly quick. But, you know, it's not a total home run. Does this go some way to sort of patching that up?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, there's the cool factor. I think you approach something like an M3 Touring in a slightly less cynical way than like the M4 CSL, which I don't think any of us were that enamored with last year, because that, you know, you've got that legendary name, it's a coupe, you're thinking, right, this is an out-and-out sports car. You get into a wagon and you just think, well, brilliant, we'll pop the lawnmower and, you know, the lawn clippings in the back and off to the tip we go. It's just, it takes itself a bit less seriously. It says that you have other priorities, you know, other than track days. So I think that's quite cool. But also I think that BMW's been working quite hard on this car sort of behind closed doors, because compared to when we first drove the car and we had our reservations, now it feels like the steering's been remapped. It feels like the gearbox has sharpened up. Just feels like they're doing little tweaks, little improvements. And yeah, sorry if you've already bought an M3, but I think it might be getting steadily better in the background.
I was very lucky to run two of the new M3s, because we also forget this is the first M3 to get four-wheel drives, but you know, which was sacrilege at first. we've also realised that's quite a sensible solution, especially when you can just swap it to two-wheel drive at the same time. But we then, as Ollie said earlier, we've spent the last week testing it against lots of different things, including the Macan GTS, a Taycan.
Yeah, so it's like a different theme. So yeah, should you just go electric? What's the electric wagon? It's a Porsche Taycan Sport Turismo. Should you just stick with a crossover? Put it up against the best crossover, a sporty one, which is the Porsche Macan. And then there were some slightly more sort of price-focused ones, because a lot of the chat around this car has been, it's 83 grand basic. And the press car that BMW very kindly sent us is £103,000, because it's covered in carbon fibre and ceramic brakes. And that is a huge amount of money for a BMW 3 Series. So I thought, well, how much fast wagon can you get for literally half the money? And that brings you to the Skoda Octavia VRS diesel, which you might scoff at, but is actually a brilliant all-rounder. And then I was looking at the optional extras fitted to this M3, and it added up to 22, 23 grand. So, of course, straight into the classifieds, how much super wagon can you get for the, just the price of the options? And quite a few. You can get a Mercs, you can get Volkswagen Group stuff, and you can get one of the finest Audis ever made, the sort of late 2000s, the B7, for all you nerds out there, RS4. And so we threw those into a test as well. And you can read all of these on topgear.com over the coming weeks.
Yeah, once Ollie's got it written.
Tested, yeah, exactly. Once we've shared them all out among the team, and it's just a case of, digging into, look, we've had to wait decades, 37 years for an M3 Touring. Now it's here. We're going to test absolutely every element of it.
Now it's here. We're going to recommend you just buy an old Audi RS4.
Well, no, the test, we were all on it earlier this week. It was really interesting. Yeah. And that M3 Touring. So when I was running the four-wheel drive one, I signed off by saying, because I think it's an M3 with the most flexibility it has, and just how you can, it's so customizable in what you can do to live with or to turn it up to go on track or whatever. And then I just thought, well, if they graft a boot onto the back of it, it is just, it could be an incredible package.
It also balances out the nose quite well, I think.
Well, I can forgive.
Yeah, that colour helps as well. That sort of frozen blue colour we've had.
But then you look at the Alpina alternative and you do realise that that is a prettier face. But as an all-round package, it is quite a phenomenal thing, especially, I have to say, when I got out of that Macan GTS and I realised it was the same price, you know, that M3 really does whip it quite hard, I thought. Yeah.
And also that the price has stopped offending me. I know we can't talk about these cars as being bargains, but when in a world now where, you know, normal electric family car starts at like 40 grand and a Honda Civic Type R is almost 50, for something that's as just finished and polished as the M3 Touring and could do everything you could reasonably expect of a car, I could sort of justify it.
I can completely, actually, because I think I would have it over any of those sort of what you call the next class up super estates, RS6 and E63 and things. I think this is a better package than they are.
Can I just offer one word of warning, though?
Go on.
I've been running around in this M3. I've obviously driven it to Switzerland and back, and then we've been doing some stuff in the UK. I have never driven any car which attracts so much chat from middle-aged men in petrol stations. And it's been, at times, quite inconvenient.
What did your girlfriend refer to it as?
The dad trap. Because, look, we're all enthusiasts and we all sometimes, you know, you give someone a knowing nod, you go, oh, cool, that's quite cool, or well done on that spec. But I have had to ask someone at one point to let me out of the petrol station shop, you know, between the Twixes and the magazines after I finished arranging them to put Top Gear at the front. Because someone just was like, that's an M3 Touring. Did you build that at home? And I went, no, it's now a factory model. And he just wanted chapter and verse on it, and I effectively ended up doing one of our like video walk arounds for him live on, you know, in a outside a petrol station forecourt. And it does attract a phenomenal amount of attention. You might think, oh, one of the appeals of the fast estate car is no one knows, it goes under the radar. This thing absolutely doesn't. Everyone wants to be
it does look awesome on the road if you're following one as well. It's presence defined, so it's amazing. But anyway, that's everything on the M3, and there is a full video of Barry Land that's on the YouTube channel now. So
there's a video of some puppies with an M3 appearing right in the middle of it as well.
Cool. So a few other little bits in the magazine. So there is a tribute to Ken Block, which was written by Chris Harris. You know, obviously incredibly, incredibly sad news. And I think this tribute really really worth a read, actually. Some lovely stories in there from Chris, who had personal experience with hanging out with him and spending time with Ken. So I think it's a really, really good tribute that Chris has written there.
Yeah, no, and we have to thank the Hoonigan guys as well. They've been, you know, we've worked, we could see them as part of the Top Gear family. We've done so much stuff with Ken and Hoonigan over the years. It's news that is still shocking us to the day, but they helped us with incredible photography of Ken's life as well throughout that. And yeah, Chris's story is super personal. So yeah, check that out.
And then finally, a Civic Type R group test. More snow. This is a snowy issue, isn't
snow
it?
Special, yeah.
It's snow special. It's that time of year. You know, no snow, and then three snow features come along at once, you know.
In Arizona, London, Switzerland, buses. And Wales.
Yeah, exactly. So this is North Wales. Civic Type R, of course, won our overall car of the year in the awards just before Christmas. Chris Harris drove the car on track. It was part of the TV film that they put together. So this was actually, in a way, the first time the Civic Type R sort of had to defend its throne, and it does quite well. But
it's interesting one, isn't it? Because In the old days, a Civic Type R test, we'd just go, right, so what are the current hot hatches? Job done. But now, because the everything,
the
price,
thinned out.
People are making fewer of them, and the price is a bit crackers. It's really worth a read, this test, because it's really diverse, isn't it? We've got a BMW four-wheel drive coupe in there. You've got the GR Yaris defending the honour of like the classic hot hatchback. There's, you know, obviously a hot Golf in there as well. It's just really diverse. It really sort of puts every element of what you could ask the Civic to do to the test.
Yeah, I mean, gone are the days when we'd do the hot hatch mega test. I remember probably 4 or 5 years ago now, when there was, you know, 15, 20 hot hatches you could pull together for this like grand shootout. And these days, yeah, as you say, it's a kind of a heartland that's being deserted in droves. But
it shows, when that test shows why we should still really care about them. I still think that's, for road cars, that is about as much performance as you need, as much engagement as you need. It's a brilliant package.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So, should we have a little quiz?
We should have a quiz? I'm up for a quiz. New year, new me. Is it? No, we're in February now, aren't
brain.
We? New brain.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm coming hot off the back of a dry January, so I should be firing pretty well up here, let me tell you. I'm looking for a big win.
Well, we've got Quizmaster.
It's at this point I already start to wince, because I know the arguments that are coming. So, for the top nine quiz to wrap up this podcast, I've gone with cars that were ahead of their time that flopped. I'm thinking of ideas that are billion-dollar businesses these days, but just arrived a little bit before the public was ready for them. Chaps, get your thinking caps on for ahead of their time flop.
He always adds like an extra little qualifier that what was that billion-dollar? So cars that were ahead of their time didn't really work back then, but these days it's a
stuff that we now
billion-dollar industries around ideas that they presented.
That's pretty much it. I'm expecting a full house from you, Jack. Now,
all right.
Would you like to go first?
I'm going to go with a car that I drove back in period, and I remember I was really drank the Kool-Aid on this one, but the Fisker Karma, and this whole idea of a plug-in hybrid, and the fact that the engine was there as to charge up the batteries, basically. Lots of noise around it, but then it died when the company went
It was
there.
LA's darling for a long time, was it?
Leonardo DiCaprio,
Did he fund one or not? I can't remember.
He basically took the first one and kind of agreed to champion
to
the brand
it.
A bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember we did a feature where we just kind of followed him around LA, paparazzo style, trying to get pictures of him in it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, whenever it was. But yeah, Fisker Karma.
Absolutely ticks all the boxes for being an ahead of their time flop, but one that I've got on this. Let's say that's an incorrect answer. Sorry, Jack.
Oh, no.
Starting the new year off with
victory.
That brain's firing all cylinders, though. Yeah, yeah. It's fine, yeah. Check the spark plugs. Can I go next?
Go on, Ryan.
The Audi A2. Super lightweight, amazing components, small, the perfect city car, basically. And then
aluminium, downsized engine.
Super efficient,
aerodynamic.
Looks cool as well, so it's desirable. Now a bit of a nightmare if you were to get hold of one, because the panels are so expensive. A tiny supermarket trolley going into it writes it off. But ahead of its time, because they didn't really sell.
If this was a top 11, those would have been two excellent.
Really?
It's on this list.
It's an incorrect answer. It's not on my list. You've got to whittle it down when it's nine. So, I've got the whole of car history to cover here. I can't just be picking cars in the last 10 years or a bit
longer. So I'm going to stick close to Rome because I did a twin test last year with an A2 because I did a little bit of research on cars that didn't quite do the business you'd expect them to do in the day and at the time. And the car that I tested the A2 against was the BMW i3 because, oh, you're nodding already. This is good news for me because that is another car like the A2, which should probably be on the list actually, and the Mercedes A-Class, maybe? They invested so heavily in. It was a really advanced car. It probably still is, if you could buy a new one now, the cleverest, lightest electric car there is. Criminally undervalued and now off sale as a result. But it did last 9 years.
But also, it's still the coolest. I think when you see them London, they are the coolest EVs that you can get.
I'll quickly put Ollie out of his misery. That is a correct answer.
There we go.
The i3 did make the list. Woo. Yeah, absolutely. Was it an aluminium frame with a carbon fibre recycled safety cell on top? My favourite fact about it, and this is one I can't take credit for researching out myself, this comes from our resident oracle, Paul Horrell, was that BMW was so obsessed with making it as lightweight as possible, it didn't even share its windscreen wiper motors with any other BMW. They re-engineered those because they wanted it just to be as light and clever and well packaged as possible. They didn't just rip something off a 3 Series. You know, that's why it was such a expensive thing to build in the end. Totally.
And now a failure. Well, it wasn't a failure, it was just ahead of its time.
But if that came out today, if the i3 came out today, no one would be like, well, that's looking a bit dated.
Yeah,
you know, it's got twice the range of a Honda E. You'd be like, good car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got the iX instead. Well done, everyone. Right, Jack. Over to you. Are we doing two guesses each?
Yeah. A couple each.
So I suppose. Final guess.
GM EV1 on the electric theme.
There's a whole documentary on this, so yeah.
Would you like to embellish on the GM EV1 or would you like me to tell you whether or not it's correct first?
Just tell me whether it's correct.
Put him out of his misery.
Scrolling down. The GM EV1 is a correct answer. This is a fascinating one for me because it's like in an alternative universe, General Motors ran away with the, you know, Clean Air Act and the Californian thirst for being right on and starting the electric revolution. Maybe Tesla never happened. Maybe Elon never bought Twitter. Maybe it was the old big three, General Motors, Ford and Chrysler in America, that started the electric car ball rolling. It could have happened. Okay, GM didn't invent it, but this, you know, streamlined tadpole of a thing came out in the 90s. It didn't have a lot of range. It did look a bit gawky, but they had a credible electric car. And then the accountants got very, very worried that running them in the future, the spare parts, the servicing was going to get a bit expensive. And America likes to be a bit litigious now and again, and they didn't want to deal with them. So they forcibly basically recalled all the cars and crushed them. And there's only very, very few. There's only one operational GM EV1 still in existence because all the ones that were kept to put in museums had to be deactivated. So they had all the gubbins kind of ripped out of them. There's only one that's actually still operable to this day with its original parts. And I think it's in the Smithsonian.
And it would have completely changed the how America operated infrastructure-wise as well. But there is an amazing documentary on that story and it's well worth the watch.
Right, Jack, you've got a point.
We're 1-0.
I'm going to go. Furious. He's still furious about the karma.
I've got 2 points in my head. I've got one, officially.
I'm going to go for the Aston Martin Lagonda because I think they're so interesting to look at now, but they never did well. They were a big luxury car, a coupe with digital instrument gear, but then they just failed, basically, in the late 70s.
Digi-dash.
Digi-dash.
Forerunner to just screens instead of dials, I suppose.
But also, the it's an absolute, well, opposite of a tile. It's huge, but there's no space inside. But it was made with a set square. That was it. Designed.
Absolutely. I love the Lagonda. What a fascinating folly. Correct answer, Ryan. You got a point as well. Yeah, I went with this mainly for the interior. Because if you look at, you know, it's not that long ago that we started getting cars with fully digital dashboards. Remember when Audi put that in the TT and we're like, whoa, this
virtual
is
proper. Virtual cockpit.
Yeah, exactly. Touch-sensitive buttons. You know, I've moaned about those in the Golf, but Aston Martin were failing at that in the 70s with the Lagonda. You know, it was such a ahead of its time interior, they had to take it all out for the when they facelifted the car and just put a conventional set of buttons back in because it was going wrong so often. But again, imagine if they had managed to kind of pursue that. You know, maybe it wouldn't be Audi that has this reputation for space age interiors now. Maybe it could have been Aston Martin back in the 20th century.
What's happening with the Lagonda? When they bring, it was during the Palmer era, is the Lagonda brand to be the luxury side of it? That's just dead.
No, that's just been parked. I think they'll probably introduce it as a kind of a bit like Mercedes and Maybach as a kind of an ultra luxury badge. Yeah. So
I think they need to get the main brand comfortable and secure first.
Maybe put a touchscreen in the DBX. Right, Ollie, the pressure's on now.
Well, actually, mentioning the DBX, so I'm going to go super SUVs. And I think the OG super SUV, if you take it all back, is the Lamborghini LM002.
Even if it's not right, it's cool.
Yeah, so I'm going to say the LM002, the Countach V12 engined
Rambo Lambo.
Yeah.
Right.
Is it?
I know Jack's driven one of these. Yeah, so he can talk about that while I say it's an incorrect answer and I'm going to run for the door. Sorry.
Not on the list. What?
Come back. Jack, tell us about driving the Rambo Lambo.
Yeah, this is a good part. We drove it. There's a disused quarry next to the... They'd just been fully restored. Were you there? Do you remember?
Yeah, I drove it. I wrote the feature. You just did the...
I did the video. It was just been restored by Lamborghini's... Polo Storico, I think it's called. Mm. And it was all going great. We were sort of biffing around this disused mine. And then right at the end, because the windscreen wipers stopped working, as they do in an LM002, but there was a big muddy puddle splash that we went through, which covered the windscreen, couldn't see what was going on. So as I went to reverse, there was just a concrete block sticking out in the middle of somewhere. And I had to go back to the factory going, great day. Thank you so much for the access. Little bit of a issue at the rear. Oh.
But it was just an external bump, like metal bull bar, basically. Yeah. That was just slightly...
You can get those at all your local hardware
stores. What was it like, though? That is a hero car from my childhood.
Yeah, it's bizarre because you know the engine under there has, you know, its roots in the Countach, so it's making extraordinary noises, but not moving at the speed related to the noise that it's making. But that makes it special because that's a weird and unique experience. We were sliding it around. It was
hilarious because it also has got that manual gearbox as well, which needs to be warm to basically work, and then you have to have done a CrossFit class beforehand to get it into gears. But
another bit like the Lagonda as well, another reverse TARDIS of like, how did they get so little interior space out of something the size of a planet?
Because it was designed as a military vehicle.
One of the great origin stories of any car, isn't it? Offered it to the US military, they said no, and they went, oh, sod you then, we'll put a Countach engine in it and sell it to oil magnates.
Also, with the first Pirelli Scorpion tyres on it, I believe, which had to take it back to the 911 Dakar to make it all
close
round
circular. Off. We've yeah. closed that
nice.
Circle.
But no, fantastic car, but also is like an FU mobile, which a lot of super SUVs are now. It was the original. But
I think it was a good and very creative answer.
Well, I do too. Yeah. I'm frankly shocked that it didn't.
What was on the list?
We've got
the problem is with you lot, all right, is that you only know cool cars. My list is full of normcore cars. Like, what about the Rover Streetwise, okay? A hatchback with plastic bumpers and a jacked up ride height that pretends to be an SUV. They're blinking everywhere now, but Rover had it in 2003, and that was on the list because it was ahead of its time. And I can see I'm losing this argument. So, okay, one more. This is my personal favourite of mine, the Tucker 48. You know, this was in a film with Jeff Bridges, I think, late 80s, well worth a watch. The first car, long before Volvo, everyone thinks Volvo invented safety because they did the seatbelt and then gave it away patent-free and side impact protection. That in 1947, this car had a central headlight which could look around corners. It had shatterproof glass. It had a shrunken dashboard so that in the event of a crash, you were hurled forward into the footwell, which was soft and cushioned, you know, because you didn't have an airbag. But back then, you know, a dashboard.
So no seatbelts on that one, though.
I think some of them have been retrofitted now. A lot of the pictures now, they do seem to have seatbelts. But it is, you know, it's a rear engine streamliner that was allegedly killed off by Ford, GM and Chrysler because they thought, good Lord, this thing's going to absolutely eat our lunch. ahead of its time in so many ways. How could you not have come up with the household name that is the Tucker Torpedo?
Dear also, me, I chaps. Think that the campaign to bring back heavily cushioned footwells starts here. What a safety feature that is. Don't worry, you'll end up in a crumpled heap in that nice squishy bit down
a
there.
That's brilliant. One. Yeah, lovely. Yeah.
Oh, comfy.
Right, 1 point each. Well done to anyone who got more than 1 point at home. And I'll try and do, like, you know, best cars with four wheels next time.
But you can see the full list of whatever else is on it that we've missed on topgear.com now and in the mag.
And in the mag each week. All right, so let's wrap it up there. That's plenty. So make sure you go and check out topgear.com, of course, for all your rolling car news and reviews and anything else that we can find. What about our socials, Ro?
We're on them. We're on them. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. But also, we have to say this at this point, I think. We need some ratings and reviews, I think, is what is necessary for podcasts. It's what I'm told and I'm pinched and punched by producers to say. It helps with us to be seen in the ecosystem of podcasts. So if you leave a rating and review, we don't mind what it says or how many stars they are, but the more the better. Please do that. But yes, check out the YouTube channel because we have so much video content coming as well. All of Ollie's trip to America, there's four videos coming out, which we can't talk about right now, but they're all very exciting. And the 911 Dakar, the M3 Touring, they're all on there. As well as, from a few issues ago, Ollie Marriage going to Korea to go to some very interesting museums, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Yes, just don't watch that one with your parents in the room. and of course, you can head to a shop and buy yourself a copy of the magazine. Fancy.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening. See you on the next one.